Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft, is at the controls. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Melba Beals. She is one of a group of African-American students who back in 1957 integrated Central High School in Little Rock, and they came to be known as the Little Rock Nine. The governor of the state resisted the integration effort, and ultimately President Eisenhower had to send in troops to enforce the Supreme Court ruling and to make it possible for these young people to go to class. They made it through that year facing continuous harassment. And at the end of the year, the governor of the state of Arkansas closed all the schools just to keep them from coming back. After that, she went on to live in California because her parents decided maybe it would be a good idea if she wasn't having to deal with that and the kind of level of threat she experienced there in Little Rock. She went on to have a career in journalism. She went to Columbia University. She worked as a news reporter for the public television station in San Francisco. That's KQED, and also for an NBC affiliate there. She has written two books about her experiences, Warriors Don't Cry, which was about her experiences growing up in Little Rock and leading up to the event, and then also a book that takes up right after that, a book that's titled White is a State of Mind. Now she spends a lot of time traveling around, speaking and so forth. And she's going to be here on the U of I campus next week. So we'll get that information together so we can pass it on to you. And, of course, here on this program, anybody who is interested in calling in, asking questions, making comments should feel welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One other thing I did want to mention here, just in terms of the kind of recognition that she has received, in 1999, all nine of the students who integrated the school were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. That's the nation's highest civilian honor. And as I say, she's joining us by telephone. Ms. Beals, hello. We got her there. I'm not quite sure what the problem is. I think we had her there on the phone. We'll just check it out here, and we'll get it going. If you'd like to call in, by the way, here, ask a question, make a comment. We do have two different numbers. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that one, good any place that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Ms. Beals?
Yes, good morning.
Oh, hello. I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I'll warn you that our phones, none of them have a singular line. So if you hear the phone ring, it's definitely me.
Oh, okay.
I'm hopeful that everybody will pick up quickly. But I'm giving you a warning.
Okay.
It's wonderful to talk to you this morning. And I hear the weather's great there. I hear you're up to 40 degrees today.
Yeah, right now it's 42, and it's pretty nice. So we're looking at some very pleasant spring-like weather, the kind of thing that after the winter you're finally thinking about actually getting out and, you know, maybe raking the leaves you should have done last fall, all that
exactly.
kind of stuff.
Exactly, or just getting out and breathing deeply.
Yes. I'm looking forward to that and doing something that doesn't involve thinking about work.
Well, we're deep in rain. Quack, 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 quack. It's been raining. I really think I'm a duck. I have feathers. Lovely brown feathers. We've been raining for many days, and we expect to rain through Sunday. So.
All right. Well, maybe it'll be a little drier here when you arrive here next week.
That'll be great.
Well, I'm interested in having, for people who are not familiar with your story, and asking some really basic questions about your experiences there when you were a girl in Little Rock, and maybe just to talk for so people can understand why it was you felt that it was so important for you and your fellow students to go to the the school that had been exclusively white.
To understand the reason for going, you have to understand the circumstance in which I lived. I rode in the back of the bus. I drank from water fountains more colored. And every year, we would get new school things, only they weren't new. They were the used ones that the white kids had used a couple years, like tables with three legs, typewriters with not all the keys, and soiled books. The decision to go to Central High School was based on one thing. It ranked 35th in the nation, even back then, as a building, just as an institution. It was 8 square blocks in diameter with 7 stories, beautifully equipped. Many of the people who left there as graduates were Rhodes Scholars going to the Big 8. So it had all the amenities that the black school did not have. The black school was a very small place with few amenities, few opportunities. So the reason for going, you know, people are really strange. They often ask me, gee, did you go just because you wanted to sit by white people? No, I didn't. I went because therein lay an opportunity for me to make my life bigger and better. And that is why the decision to go. Because Central High School also used my mother's tax money to buy all that good stuff that I didn't have the advantage of. I mean, they had, like, apartments set up as kitchens for home economics, which everybody took back then. They had a band pit with all the latest instruments, and they had the forerunners of computers. Yeah. This, so it was really a beautiful plant, just basically.
And it seems this is obviously very important, because in all the things I've read about you, interviews and stories in which you're quoted, it seems that you always make that point that this was not, in your mind, this was not about integration. This was about opportunity for you and going to what was not only was the best school in town, it was one of the best schools in the country. And you figured future was...
People shouldn't confuse your decisions here. And people should, I always, when I talk, and like I give diversity seminars for faculty and you know, universities around the country, I say, let's get clear here about the definition of integration. Integration is not a word that stands on its own. Integration really means access to opportunity. For my particular point of view, you could never say the word integration again. You could erase it from the dictionary. But what is apropos here, what we needed was access, because when you are shut out, when anybody's shut out from the mainstream of opportunity, you need access. All I want is a choice. I don't want to marry you. I want my 2 cars in the garage. I'm a material girl. I wanted the opportunity to do what I've done, which is to make the best career I can make.
After the Supreme Court made its ruling in 1954, at that point, the decision was made, I'm sure, in various places. People said, well, now that the court has said that separate but equal is not going to fly anymore, we're going to go and we're going to seize that kind of opportunity. But to say that and then actually do it, that's another thing. How was it that it happened to be you and these other young people that were the ones that were going to, you know, going to push it there in Kansas, in Little Rock?
The court said that these schools had to integrate, and in the beginning they chose 116 people who had good grades who could do it. Now, then the Little Rock School Board said, we're not going to do them all. Don't be silly. We're only going to do Central High School. Mm-hmm. And eventually, because of the threats and because of the decisions of the school board, it was refined to 9 people. Those 9 people had to have excellent grades and no history of violence.
You were just 15 years old at the time?
15 going on 16.
15 going on 16. That's an awful lot for a 15-year-old, awful lot of weight for a 15-year-old to carry.
Well, you know, as a 15-year-old, of course, we didn't understand what we were doing. We didn't think of it as large as it was going to become. We thought we'd go to this new school. Like any new school, we'd be unwelcome a little bit at first. We had no idea that people would get their guns out and get their ropes out and gather in mass to keep us out.
Because what happens is that when you went to go, not only were there was there this mob.
Huge rampaging mobs. And when I see pictures of that today on Eyes on the Prize, or any of the film that's left over, I absolutely wonder what my parents were thinking and what I was thinking at the time. I mean, we're talking hundreds of people with ropes around their shoulders and ugly plans for my body. But we didn't get that. I mean, I didn't get it. So to say that at the time I was a heroine, you'd be incorrect. Naive would be another word. Unsuspecting would be another word. And certainly, you know, it felt, my mother would later say, my mother was very bright, and a professor who spoke, you know, six languages, now in a coma. She's quite ill. But she, in hindsight, will say that it felt like an inexorable trip, as though God had planned this happening. It felt as though we were all being ushered down this spiritual road or philosophical road. And things happened so fast that decision-making was sometimes left to the moment.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Melba Beals, she is one of the Little Rock Nine who sought to desegregate Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas back in 1957 successfully, although it did take an order by the president backed by federal troops to get them admitted. She tells that story in her book Warriors Don't Cry, and there's another that follows the period after that, White is a State of Mind. So if you're interested in reading about her story, you can look for those books. Also, she will be giving a talk on the U of I campus on Monday, talking on the topic integration then and now. And her speech will be at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Illini Union on the U of I campus. And I'm sure anyone interested in hearing her should feel welcome to attend. Here on this program, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here, someone on a cell phone who'd like to talk on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First of all, I wanted to say that I was born in 1956 of a biracial couple and, of course, heard about your guest my whole life growing up and always wondered where she found the courage. And you have just said that initially, not a lot of courage was perhaps involved because you didn't know what you were facing. You had no idea of what was upcoming. I understand that, but after you knew, what made you come back the second week, the third week, after Christmas break? Where did you find the courage to continue?
Thank you for the question. You know, it's a really simple prayer. And, you know, when I was writing my book, all of the editors that came past it would always say, tell us what really happened here. I mean, tell us why you really were able to go back. Very simple prayer. I was a very religious young lady. Now, about the third time I went to Central High School, I really became quite aware of the fact that people were willing to kill us. Because I was that awful picture that you see of Elizabeth Eckford walking down that strip in front of the school, no one to protect her, with white people sort of at her heels barking. And when she got home that day, you could wring the saliva out of her dress. But that scene, we were on the other side. And that was the first time my mother and I, you know, up close and personal, these gentlemen with ropes around their shoulders were threatened to hang us. And that's when I realized, wait a minute, integration is this huge word, because we had to race to our car. We barely got away. But it was also on that day that I discovered what my grandmother had said was true. She had always said all of my life, because it was a very religious family, to church 3-4 times a week, certainly every Sunday, lots of prayer. I mean, anything was prayer, on your knees, prayer. And so she'd always said to me, God is as close as your skin. You have but to ask, and you'll be helped. You'll get the help. So here we are. We're being chased down the block by these men who are telling us what they're going to do to us. You know, we got a nigger right here. We're going to hang him, da-da-da-da-da-da. What we're going to do to you before we hang you? And my mother and I are running up the street trying to get back to our car. And this guy reaches out and grabs, because my mother's behind me, grabs her jacket, pulls it backwards, and almost gets a hold of her. But at this point, I tested Grandma out. I said, okay, God. And I started praying, you know, 23rd Psalm in the Lord's Prayer. And by some great helping hand, the men who were running behind us, we ran around this brush that was in the road. They didn't look down to see it. The first guy tripped, and that set up a domino effect where that gave us just a few seconds we needed to get to the car. So, yes, indeed, There is no magic to this. The only thing I can tell you is the magic of prayer every day, every moment. I know, for example, that you can say the Lord's Prayer 13 and a half times, going from the first to the third floor. So that's it, prayer, and also very strong grandma and mother. You know, very, very strong. My mother grew up to become a teacher, but that's because she walked 10 miles a day to school. My grandmother worked as a maid in White Lady's Kitchens for a dollar a day, but came home at night to read Shakespeare. She would take books out of their garbage cans and restore them, restore globes for us. So, you know, learning was the essence of our life, and the Bible was the base of it. We were Bible thumpers.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Sure.
Thank
and
you for
I want to say one more thing, which is also because there's no alternative. When things are going so rough for you, you seek a way out, and there was no alternative. For me, people having this big discussion today about did Brown work? Well, hello, folks. There was no alternative. What were we going to do, you know?
Not only was this very hard on you and the other students, it was also very hard on your families because they experienced an awful lot of pressure. The community put pressure on them all the ways that they could to pull you out of the school.
Absolutely. My mother lost her job at one point, and pressure was put on by the media and by the local bishops to get her job back because my mother was a single parent. My folks were divorced, and my mother was my sole supporter. I had a younger brother who would grow up to become a captain of the Arkansas State Police, first black one, the first black U.S. Marshal, you know, ever appointed in the South in his district. But all that was because we have really, really strong folks. But on the other hand, of the Little Rock Nine, I not long ago wrote an article about it, something 6 out of 9 of those people lost their jobs. One of the fathers, Carlotta Lanier's dad, had to leave Arkansas to go work in St. Louis. He worked a bit, I think, in Chicago as well, as a contractor because he no longer could work in Arkansas. You know, this is also not a story just about the struggle of black people. It's a story about the people who also helped us, rabbis, priests. Then some of the white men got together, and for the one, Jefferson Thomas's dad, they actually gave him jobs around their houses to sustain him. So there were Christians. There were people in there. Christians or not, Jews, everybody sort of chimed in, the people who had spirit to support us. Quakers came down from the north to back us and teach us nonviolence. A lot of people gave a lot. Some gave their lives for this effort.
We'll talk with someone else here in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. You've described some racial hatred that is almost incredible. And when you hate that badly, when people hate that badly, they don't feel good. That it doesn't feel good to hate that way. Describe their souls must have been blighted. Has anyone commented on you that they were relieved when they finally were free of that hatred, or were they free of that hatred? You must have had some experience because the people who hated that badly, They were blighted themselves, weren't they?
I would agree with you that kind of hatred always eats you. And since that incident on the Oprah Winfrey Show, I met a couple of the people. She had a show a couple of years ago where she had on there some of the people that had sort of tortured us. And some of them were actually quite apologetic. It was very interesting. The one guy was a guy who did nothing. His sole job during my time there was to walk on my heels. And
yeah.
Ever had anybody walk on your Achilles tendon all day long?
Yeah.
I'm here to tell you, it hurts. I'm now 62. It still hurts. On a damp day, if I walk, I feel that. That guy said, well, he thought maybe he had a crush on me.
Oh.
To forgive him. And I said, you know, I am not yet to the level that Mother Teresa has attained. I cannot, in all honesty, tell you that I'm able to dine with you. I have forgiven you, though. And one of the things that's been important to me was to forgive.
Yeah.
I've received a lot of awards. I've received a forgiveness award because I do not carry hatred. My grandmother used to say, if you hate, you might as well chew on a lemon because all that sour stuff gets in your system. And so better to chew on a nice sweet mint. and hatred doesn't get you anywhere. So she would daily, you know, preach to us from the Bible, reading me verses about forgiveness and saying that it was really important to see all of the people, even those who were embattled and empowered to, at the time, really torture us. It was really important to see them as God's children and to love them and to try and love them, to understand that they, too, were in a bind. Yeah. In that this was a big change that they had been taught traditionally not to accept. This certainly altered the course of their high school activities. But it's hard to do. You know, it was really hard at that age, at 15, to do. Because I wanted my life to be normal, and I wanted people to stop what they were doing. But some of the people have come forth to say they're sorry. On the other hand, a few years back when we were in Arkansas, then Governor Bill Clinton gave us a huge reunion the late 80s, and we had people calling on the phone saying, you know, there's a bomb threat, or we still hurt you. But the difference then was I had two cousins who were police. My brother was a captain of the state police, and my cousin was the mayor, so things had changed.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call.
God bless you. Have a good day.
An awful lot of the focus, I'm sure, is on, first of all, your first attempt to go to school and being turned back by the mob, and then eventually the president calling out, sending federal troops, U.S. Army troops, to make it possible for you to go.
God bless them wherever they are today. I pray for them.
Once that
101st Airborne.
Indeed. Once that happened, and then you actually got in and you started going to school, I mean, eventually the troops went away. And then you hung in, though. You went for an entire year. What went on once the kind of the spotlight was off? What sort of things went on? What did you have to deal with just day to day, just trying to go about your business and go to class?
Well, once the federal troops left, the governor had promised the president that he would install, you know, the National Guard. And that was, these gentlemen did their personal best, but they were not the 101st. We had great difficulty, acid in the eyes, beat up daily. It was like going to war. I say it was like putting on your saddle shoes every morning, going to war. And once again, the thing that stood between me and my demise was prayer. And also, the soldier who guarded me, when I had federal troops, I had a close-up soldier, bodyguard, one-on-one. Then you had your perimeter troops, two or three at a distance, and then a greater number at a greater distance. The guy who was my personal bodyguard, whom I called Danny in the book, taught me a lot. And one of the things, the reason the book's called Warriors Don't Cry, is because he echoed what my grandmother had said. She always sung this hymn, I am a warrior on the battlefield for my Lord, and I promise him that I'll do the best until I die. And this soldier came along and he said, Melba, you're a warrior here. You cannot lay down and cry. Somebody kicks you in the gut, roll over, get up, keep moving. And he taught me a lot about, he said, you don't have time to cry. You just don't. You got to keep moving. You're going to get injured the second time if you take time to muse over it. And that was really helpful. And he said to me at one point, somebody should have given you guys military training because you're a war girl. Stand up against this wall, breathe deeply, and walk forward. And so he taught me a lot about posture. But nevertheless, when those soldiers left, it was absolute unmitigating hell, to the extent that as adults, when we went back to that school, I remember the first time we went back, you know, many of us cried as 40-year-old adults with pot bellies and starting gray hair, because there's no getting past what it did to our self-esteem and what it did to our spirits.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. We have another caller, someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I tuned in late, so I'm not sure whether you've covered this, but how did these nine happen to get chosen?
The nine children, were then children, were chosen by your grades. Originally, as I explained earlier, there were like more than 100 people chosen, and some parents backed out because of threatened violence. Others backed out because they just didn't want to deal with it, and then the school eliminated some. So one of the criteria for the choice was that you had to make good grades, that you had to have a clear record of nonviolence, because they knew from the beginning that if we ever responded, we were nine, they were 1,800, almost 1,900. So this is not an occasion on which you can respond And so from the beginning, we were taught that your position is one of nonviolence. And so they picked students that they thought could make that cut.
And did you have nonviolent training?
Oh, absolutely. Quakers came down from the north. It was a gentleman at the time named Sparhall, and several Quaker people came down. Many people intervened. Out of Canada, Quakers came. And their sole job there was to teach us nonviolence.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Right.
Sure.
Well, thank you for
not only
call.
For the program, but for your courage to do that.
Well, you're welcome. You have a good day.
All right. Thanks for the call. We're a little bit past the midpoint here, and I do want to mention again for people who are listening that our guest, Melba Beals, will be here in Champaign-Urbana on the U of I campus on Monday, March 1st, giving a talk, the topic Integration Then and Now, 7 o'clock in the evening at the Illini Union on the U of I campus. And, of course, anybody who is interested should feel welcome to attend. And no matter where you are, if you're interested in reading her story, she has written two books. The first, titled Warriors Don't Cry, about the kind of experiences here that we've been talking about and what happened to her in Little Rock there in 1957. Then she's also authored a second book, which is about her time after her life after that, White is a State of Mind. So you can go and look for those books. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So why did your parents make the decision, or maybe it was your mom or your family at any rate, at the end of that year for you to leave Arkansas and go to live in California?
By the end of that first year, the governor of Arkansas had closed schools. And that was very disheartening because the black people by this time were almost as angry at us as the white people. They were angry because in retaliation, the white community was taking away their jobs. Black community was in some ways 100% dependent on them for jobs, for resources, because we didn't own anything. We owned like a newspaper. Mrs. Daisy Bates and her husband owned the only black newspaper. So by the end of that time, also, here's an important reason we had to leave. The Ku Klux Klan had bills out on us, 10,000 alive, 5,000 dead. Or vice versa. Sorry, let me change that. 10,000 dead, 5,000 alive.
More, you're worth more dead than alive.
That's right. And in that time, think about it. In 1957, $10,000 was a house.
Yeah.
Right. I remember my mom got a house for $9,000. Right. So that was equivalent to saying what, a half million today or more, dead. And you know, shopping money, say $250,000. Are so alive. And so I also had at the time relatives who were passing for white, like everybody does. And I had a relative who called up. He was at the time a sheriff with a white family and everything, but he would come back to Arkansas periodically to visit his mom. And he called my mother and said, look, they're putting out invitations all over the network chain of the Klan for people to come there and kill these children. You need to get her out of there. And 3 or 4 days after that, my mother started sewing, my mother and grandmother, you know, sewing furiously, you know, to get me out. And see, that now, you know, a year elapsed. We went to school from 57 to 58. Then from September 58 to 59, I had to wait in Little Rock because the NAACP had that case in process. Hmm. So from September 58 to, say, May 59, I was out of school, just sitting. And then in the latter part of that year, it was when my relative called and said, look, you need to get her out of there.
Hmm.
And I ended up coming to California and was taken in by a white family, adopted by a white family here. That's what the second book is about. The hilarious experience of getting off the plane, expecting to be met by members of the NAACP. Well, in fact, they were from Santa Rosa, and in California, members of the NAACP were all white. Because unfortunately, the black members, of which were about five, had gotten lost on the way to the airport. And so when I got off the plane, there were all these white people standing there, rushing towards me. And I was absolutely horrified, because I thought, well, the Klan who had sought me in Arkansas had now followed me to California. But that would begin the change, the bridge in my life, because the parents that I met, Dr. and Mrs. George McCabe, who are still my parents today, and those four sisters and brothers, still my sisters and brothers today, would in effect walk me over the bridge to adulthood.
Yeah, because you had to leave Little Rock without actually graduating from high school.
That's correct, because I was a junior. The only graduate of Central High School at that time was Ernie Green. Mm-hmm. Now, later on, Claudia Lanier and Jefferson Thomas would graduate, but they would be brought back in January of 50, actually 60, and go back to school then.
We have some other calls here. Folks would like to talk with you? Let's do that. And the next in line is in Urbana, and that's line one. Hello.
Good morning, Ms. Mm-hmm. Fields. It's really an honor to hear your voice, and I'm so happy you're coming to campus. I've taught your book in my classes, and I've made it required that my students go. So we will be there in the front row on Monday. But I was calling because your book inspired me to drive down to Little Rock, Arkansas last summer. I just wanted to see that school myself, and I was struck by how much it has become a tourist attraction. I think it's good, but at the same time, I walked through the arch. There's this big arch in front of the school that has pictures of the history and everything, and there seems to be, whoever put that up seems to have a real defensive posture about that school. I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit about what's happened since, contemporary times. They keep touting the school as a place where everyone can come and be educated, but I understand it's predominantly black school now.
Yeah, sadly so. It's about 70% black now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite unhappy with the fact that it's what's called a track school. Do you know what that means?
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. For everybody who doesn't know what a track means, it means that if you come into school and they sense or test you in a certain lane, then you stay in that lane through that school. And it means that they make up their minds, are you going to be a carpenter or an intellectual?
Mm-hmm.
And they, from the beginning, only give you courses on a lower track, let's say, so that if you have a learning difference, then you're not educated at the highest level. So we're not happy with that. And, in fact, until recently, Dr. Terry Roberts, who is one of the Little Rock Nine, was trying to work with them on a better integration plan, because certainly the problem isn't solved.
Mm-hmm.
Have things changed? Yes. In 89, when we went back, the president of the student body was black, and it was more of a balance. But of recent, it has become more black. We are questioning whether or not the education opportunity is what it was. And so, yes. And the other thing that's happened is Little Rockians, who before carried ropes and wanted to hang us, have now determined that we bring money to the state. So they have set up a museum, and that school is a huge, huge tourist attraction.
Yeah, yeah.
It needs a bit of work as it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has some problems with crime and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the neighborhood needs a bit of uplift.
Yeah, I did notice that.
Now, I have to know that when I went to school there, this was an all-white, very wealthy neighborhood that we couldn't drive through at night.
Oh, okay.
That was someplace you didn't go after 5 o'clock, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's definitely changed radically, as the whole country has changed in these last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully there is a turnaround. The state legislature has recently voted to, which surprised us, put statues of us in that park that's there. And so there have been a lot of changes in the disposition of the mainstream people in Little Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And they have certainly undergone their own metamorphosis.
I have one quick question. There was a man running for president who was from Little Rock, Arkansas, and I'm forgetting his name. I'm just in such a hurry right now. But did he attend that high school? Because when he launched his campaign, he went to a elementary school in Little Rock and said, I'm from this town. This is where I went to school. But he's about your age. I was wondering if he was at your high school.
I don't know that,
because
I don't know. I know that there were a lot of claims. There are a lot. You'd be amazed at the claims that are made and at the questions I get daily of people. At this point, because we've become so famous and because we have this medal and are written about all the time, we have all these claims made that people went to school with us or stood by us or whatever, and I would say probably 80% of them are not correct.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's kind of fun, though, you know, in a way. I just hope they're all blessed by this claim.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to your visit, and thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go to another caller here. Loda is next, line 4. Hello.
Loda?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I thank you, and I bow to you in respect for your innocence and for your devotion to your beliefs, for opening the door to the opportunity that you spoke about earlier for a better life.
Oh, thank you.
My question is this. Before you, there was the reason of the blocked access to a good education and to the opportunity for this good life, the American dream that we all wish to have. Why is it that the Latinos and the blacks seem to be the only majority of people that don't wish to walk through this door that you opened so many years ago? I would like to know your
view. Well, you mean don't wish to walk together?
No.
Or don't wish to walk?
Don't wish to walk through the door of opportunity that you opened for everybody else after you. I mean, in before you, there was the reason to explain why a lot of black people and people of color did not have the opportunity for education and a good life. And then after you, you made the change. You opened that door. You made it happen. But now there is no closed doors, but still a lot of people are not passing through it. I would like to know why.
You're going back to my allegation and my decision to tell you in the beginning of this conversation that really integration is not the word we're looking for. It's accessibility. And in truth, in this country, lines of demarcation are green. They're drawn by money. And so many of the Latinos in this country, and I deal in California, of course, with this issue big time. I am also a professor at a university here, Dominican University, and we have a great Latino populace coming into our university. We have worked over the past, I have worked with a group called DAG over the past 5 years, the Diversity Action Group, DAG, to get Latinos to come in, specifically focusing on those two. Because
still,
they are left out. And I think that black people and Latino people don't choose to walk through the door simply because they still are denied access because of resources. They're ignorant of what it means to walk through the door. If you don't have... Recently I watched on one of the bigger shows, I think 2020, the whole story about this awful, awful housing project. And, it's the KQED special called Beyond the Color Line. And in that, they go into this incredible housing project where all these black people are. And he shows you that generation after generation, those women believe that what we need to do is get pregnant, have more babies, so that we get more income. Nobody tells them, look, folks, this isn't the answer. The answer is to go get some education, take your birth control pill, accelerate for yourself. So a lot of this has to do with accessibility. Pile hundreds of people into a dense housing project where everybody is sick in terms of their understanding of what's possible, and you get a mess. But you see, it used to be a long time ago that people lived in neighborhoods. And in those neighborhoods was a fireman, an ambulance driver, a teacher, a doctor, etc. And in those neighborhoods, the children got to see the fireman outdoors mowing his lawn. They got to see the realities of this person. And so what we need now is role models. We need to have people who have made it that are black and Latino go into housing projects, go into the poor areas and say, hello, here I am, I've made it. And I do that often. I tell people often, aren't you blessed with this opportunity to make it? Congratulations.
Well,
and let me show you how. And so that's the problem. It's ignorance. I write about in White's a State of Mind how I lived in a housing project in order to get my education. And guess what? Every single morning, these drummers got up, and they played the drum every morning. And my question to you is, where, so one day I went out and I asked them, I said, what are you doing? You got up, you got dressed, you're playing the drums, the conga drums. What's the issue here? Why don't you go to school? Why don't you go to work? And they said, you know, even if we go to school or work, we aren't going to get anything. I said, well, I'm here to tell you, you are going to get something. So part of this is ignorance. Part of this is that the people who have made it don't go back to hold the hands of those who have not.
Well, thank you. Wonderful answer.
Thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left, or rather, no, maybe more like 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking with Melba Beals. She was one of the group of students who came to be known as the Little Rock Nine, who were involved in the battle to integrate Little Rock Central High School, Little Rock, Arkansas, back in 1957. And again, if you're interested in reading her account of her experiences, it's published it as a book. It's titled Warriors Don't Cry, and it is in print, so it should be out there in the bookstore or the library. And then also a volume that follows after that talks about her experiences then after having left Little Rock and living in California, where she went to high school, completed her high school, and then went on to college and career as a journalist. That book is titled White is a State of Mind. So those books are out there if you want to read them. And we do have some more people here who have questions. Let's go to Champaign County is our next, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'll try and be short, and I just actually have two comments. I just attended a forum last night, and I was shocked to find out, and other people were too, that the average school's classroom size in the Chicago school system now, which is primarily hyper-segregated people of color, is 55.
Scary.
It's absolutely stunning. It's awful. But that's just sort of follow on to what I was just hearing there about, which I think I want to capsulize as more blaming the victim. But what I called about really was the African American Research Program here recently screened a film called The Intruder from 1962, and it dramatizes the integration of a school in the South in a small town. It's not like Little Rock. Little Rock is not a small town, but it's well worth seeing. It's done by Roger Corman, who did horror films after that. But I don't know if you've seen that, but I recommend it for everyone because it's dated. It's from 1962. It also came out. It has a curious history of release. It was also released under the name Shame, and it was also released under the title I Hate Your Guts.
Oh, so, lovely name.
And it has William Shatner in it, which is kind of why. But it's called The Intruder. And it really is a moving film. I mean, there's a lot of anachronisms and odd things in it, but it does dramatize a rural southern community and a move to integration and an interloper who comes in and tries to stir up and does successfully stir up the whites against the project. So,
thanks for the information.
Very good. Thank you.
Right. You have a happy day.
Thank you.
We have, again, time for about 10 minutes, time for other calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455 for here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. When you moved to California and went to high school there, it was also a school where you were one of very few African Americans.
What was
your experience there?
That was scary. And my book, White is a State of Mind, talks about how even though I was never threatened and it was the most wonderful place in the world, I still wasn't totally included. But my white sisters and my brother then was quite young, so he wasn't going to high school. I had two sisters going, and they were really sweet in that they were just plain folks. And they would say, hey, this is our sister Joy, which they called me at the time. And, you know, they never made a big thing of it. They just said, this is our new sister Joy. They'd introduce me around, and that would be it. And so I would go places with them sometimes and do things. But, you know, I didn't have a normal dating life and because I was in this other place. And the most important thing here that shut me out was a lack of understanding of that culture. These people were free. They lived a certain life that I had not understood. But what was great for me was the freedom that I got in my spirit and those parents. I mean, could I have gotten better parents? My dad would go on to be one of the founders of Sonoma State University, excuse me. My mom is an activist. She's a Quaker. Both these guys are Quakers. My mom is an activist. She's still alive today. She's 86. She does Gashtanga yoga 3 times a week. she backpacks into the Marble Mountains. She just founded something called the Russian River Celebration. She is so cool. I mean, if we could all keep up with Mom. Recently, she went on a backpack with my brother, who weighs like 260, and Mom had to carry his backpack down for him. She weighs under 100 pounds. And so look at the two spirits. Look at the gifts that God gave me, which was I went from this environment where I was totally castigated to this environment where I was totally loved. And my mom and dad never, ever made a difference. Dr. and Mrs. McCabe always embraced me. Daddy would always say, understand, you are never less than my daughter. And he's really the only loving father I ever knew. And he had a lot to do with helping me to understand what freedom is really like. Now, I would tell you that Thurgood Marshall, coming to the South, was the first person who brought me a real enactment of freedom. My parents had talked about it, but Thurgood Marshall, Justice Marshall, was free. And he was a great figure in my life. When I turned 50, I adopted identical twin boys. And to let you know how dear he is in my life, I named my sons Matthew Thurgood, and my other boy is Evan Marshall. And so, surely, you know, this man, Thurgood Marshall, was an incredible role model. But then along would come my parents, white parents, to finish up the job. And so I'm very blessed.
I did want to ask you about the thing you just mentioned, just because, that's a time of life when a lot of people would say, I am done with dealing with children, at least that of children of that age. What moved you at 50-something to decide that you wanted to adopt these two little boys?
Well, you know, the thing about me is I had been for 18 years on the board of something called ASC, Aid to Adoption of Special Children. That is an adoption agency created by the DeBolts, Dorothy and Bob DeBolt, and you've seen the movie about the DeBolts and all the work that they have done. And I was, for 18 years, I was with them initially when they started, and for 18 years I was on that board, seeing to it that 10,075 kids got adopted in the 10 years. Now, I was on a lot of boards. I turned 50. I was having a good old time. I just, you know, published my book, and I was hanging out, spending money, shopping and all that. But my mother always said to me, and my grandmother, they would say to me, every single year on your birthday, you must look at what you're giving back for what you've gotten. That was one thing. The other thing was, rather than being on a whole bunch of boards, why not, why not give directly, I decided. And so I resigned from my boards. And the other thing was, I had promised God that if I published my book and if it worked out, if it indeed was a valid and valuable piece of work, that I would adopt. I would do what I've been asking other people to do. I'd walk my talk. And so I saw these little boys on television, and that was it. I mean, I just saw one of them, and he resembled my birth daughter. And I called up about him, and they said to me, you know, you're 50, you can't do it, blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, but I've had 2 years of law, and you can't tell me that. You are bound by law to some of the applications. And I made application, and they said, well, you won't get them. 100 people have you know, requested it, and they're younger than you. And I said, yeah, but you can't tell me that. Send me the application. And I did. And about 7 months later, they had eliminated those 100 down to 25, and I was in the 25, partially because my family's integrated. And because I was a stay-at-home mom, I could write and stay at home at that point. Now I've gone back to teaching. But, for a number of reasons, I was blessed with these young men. And now they wear size 11 shoe. And they are, they're bean poles. They're skinny kids. They're 5'8".
And how old are they now?
They're now 13. And they're so wonderful. Whew. They're so wonderful. And when I got them, they were just turning, four? Yeah. So, you know, it's been a big job, another spiritual bit of growth. God always grabs me up and says, listen, let's go one more mile. Let's get this other lesson going on. Mm. And so, really, raising two boys, I got to tell you, it has been an extreme growth lesson, one which has certainly kept me young, kept me moving. I got to get up, get to the soccer field, make those lunches. I got to do it all. And it's a fun thing for me now. It's just like this huge, wonderful thing in my life.
Yeah. And now you have a grown-up daughter. How old is she?
I have a grown-up daughter. She won't let me say that on the air.
Oh.
She's 30-something, and she's working on her doctorate degree in psychology. And she's actually, for the moment, come back to stay with me for a bit because the task of raising the boys has been so daunting. It's just it's a huge thing to give love, to support, to and get these two spirits launched. And actually, I'm writing two books right now. One is called Why Go Where You're Not Welcome. That's a predative of Warriors, in which I talk about, you know, what leads you to want to do that. And the other one's called How to Launch a Spirit. And that's about, you know, my decision to adopt and what you have to be willing to contribute in order to get these little spirits on the road.
Yeah. So do they think of their sister as a big sister or as another mom?
She really is legally, you know, she signed on the dotted line with me. She's a legal guardian to them. But she's big sister. You know, she wears a ponytail and jeans. And they usually ask, you know, sister lets them chew bubble gum in the car. I will not. Sister's younger, so she's able to do things with them that I do not do. She's the one who goes to the, you know, the park with them, you know, to take them riding on the Ferris wheel and all the big things like that. And she's the one who teaches them how to dance. And so they think of her as a big sister. And, you know, they'll get really angry at her. They don't really quite see her as an adult. So they'll say, you know, things like, you let sister stay out past 11, or you let sister, you know, sister gets to go on the weekends. Because their bedtime's 8:30 during the week. Well, sister gets to stay up till 11.
You know? Well, you can say, well, yeah, she's 30 years old.
Exactly. And so they don't totally get that she's a grown-up. Hmm. And, you know, they'll say things like, sister's driving. You know, why can't we? So they don't totally get it. But Big Sister has been a godsend and has certainly brought a part of their life that they would not have had, because I'm a little old lady. Let's get real here.
Well, I don't know about that. You're gonna have to wait probably a few decades before you could qualify to be on a little lady.
Oh, a cheerful one. That's what's important.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you, Ms. Beals, very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. For people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, our guest Melba Beals will be giving a talk on the U of I campus on Monday, March 1st, 7 in the evening, Integration Then and Now, that's the title, at the Illini Union on Green Street on the campus. And, of course, if you want to read her story, you can look for the two books we mentioned. First, Warriors Don't Cry, and the other, White is a State of Mind. And again, Ms. Beals, thanks very much.
Happy day. Have a blessed day.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Also, from the Krannert Center.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, participating in the U of I Brown vs. Board of Education commemoration with the Department of Theater presentation of Lorraine Hansberry's play, A Raisin in the Sun, opening March 11th, and with in-progress showings of work being created by performance artist Ralph Lemon to be premiered at Krannert Center. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about